This is the Nuance Podcast by Medicine Explained. We're your hosts, Amanda
and Dan.
We talk to experts on health, the human experience, and the intersection of climate and human health.
We explore the nuance that's been lost in today's conversation. We don't take ads because we want to keep our information unbiased.
But we do need your support. So leave a review on Apple or Spotify.
And share with your friends or on social media.
In today's conversation, we speak with Dr. Anthony Gustin, DCMS, who is a former sports rehab clinician turned entrepreneur, author, podcaster, investor, and amateur farmer. He's currently working on some new projects to help save our food system and scale regenerative agriculture. He last founded Perfect Keto to help people with metabolic dysfunction and Equip Foods to provide people with whole food nutrition supplementation. He continues to explore how to live like a human on his podcast, The Natural State Podcast, and authors his newsletter, The Feed. In this conversation, we talk about what it means to be in our natural state and how he became interested in regenerative agriculture. We go into depth about some of the main inflammatory factors of the standard American diet, specifically focusing on oils. Dr. Gustin helps to explain why certain oils are unhealthy, which ones we should avoid, and which ones are okay to eat. This was a really interesting conversation, and I learned a lot. We hope you do too. Now, on to the podcast. Hi, Dr. Gustin. Welcome to the Nuance Podcast. I'm really excited to chat with you today. I've just binge listened to all of the podcasts you've been putting out there, and I really like your content, so I'm super excited to get into it with you today.
Well, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, awesome. So I just want to start off with a journey question. How did you get interested in nutrition?
Oh, boy. Well, my nutrition fascination started when I was a fat kid and tried to figure out, well, how can I not be fat anymore? I tried everything that everybody else told me. It didn't work. So I sort of figured it out myself. And it went from kind of standard American diet. The first phase was eating the whole wheat bread with the lean turkey breast, things like that, light mayo. And I actually saw quite a lot of changes from just doing that. And that a lot of people do when they cut out even like the ultra processed stuff and shift towards that. And so that was the first thing in my head that started a very obvious understanding that what you put in your mouth and in your body and what you eat affects you and how you feel and how you think and everything else like that. And so kind of got upset at that point. Obviously, I'm very different. That how I consume food now is very different than that. And I think the journey for a lot of people looks very different. But standard American diet to now, I try to, I'm traveling a little bit right now. But if in Austin, try to eat as much food that I produce myself. If not, the second tier, or hunting in the second tier is literally knowing my farmers. It's hard for me to eat, especially day to day, without knowing where my food comes from. I think I have a connection now on the journey that I have with food that goes beyond just taste and what I think is nutrition, which we can get into of like my philosophy and food and how it's changed. But yeah, I eat seasonally now and try to know where as much of my food comes from as possible. But yeah, the journey started when I was a fat little kid.
Yeah, I would love to get into your journey with how you started eating and what your diet looks like now and how the research and the nutrition has evolved. But I also am interested, were you initially seeing patients and were you recommending dietary interventions? And did you see that help other folks as well as yourself? And it kind of catalyzed your change in mind?
Yeah, by the time I was, I think undergrad, was going through there, when I was ending that period of time, I was still tweaking, still getting new stuff. I actually experimented with ketosis in 2005. Again, more of a physique thing. I was just still dealing with being overweight when I was younger, trying to lose the last few pounds, get up, optimized, but also more importantly for studying. And I was into some weird blogs back then. I can't even remember what they were called. And some of my friends and I actually from a biochemistry class were like, it makes sense with this pathway for to not eat carbohydrates that this should happen and we should lose more fat. So should we try this? And then we did it. And it worked. But yeah, there was no talk of ketosis at that point. But at the end of that phase of my life, I was definitely getting into more quote unquote paleo, stuff like that. I mean, I think Rob Wolf was just starting to put out stuff on the back of Lauren Cordain, and that all that just like started to make sense for me way more. And I think that there's way more nuance to be talked about with regarding nutrition. And I don't think there's any, you know, we should have any romantic view of we need to recreate the past per se. But I think that to me, it's just so obvious and common sense now. Like, we literally have not made any new food in the last 100 years, new food ingredient that has been good for us, like a net positive for our health. And if that's the case, then I think we should probably look at the past. Like, and I'm willing to be proven wrong. If you have any examples or if anybody else wants to send me any examples, I've been searching for them just because I want to have the truth and I want to know as much as possible. And I haven't found any foodstuffs that we have created in the last 100 years that have been positive for us. So it was just digging into that stuff, getting new frames on it, and honestly, experimenting. I think that there's been a lot of nutrition that has kind of come and gone for me, at least, where each thing I've learned, I've kind of assimilated it as rules and then appreciated the nuance within it. And I've always been a big fan of individual approaches to nutrition. So fast forward to grad school, I was arguing with my nutrition professors abundantly because they were talking about just ridiculous stuff. I mean, at that point, I thought the things were absurd. If you must eat high grain and you must not eat protein and, you know, the standard thing. And so nutrition was actually one of the first things that I assessed with patients. I tried to do my intake. We had intake form of, dealing with mostly when I started my clinic, sports med stuff, musculoskeletal injuries, things like that. So if somebody has sprain strain, chronic pain, acute pain with their actual body, that's mostly what I focused on when I started practice. But if you don't have proper building blocks, if you don't have the proper environment of things that you're actually consuming, I just noticed working with pro athletes, even if their diet sucked, they would get injured so much more frequently. And some of these guys that had chronic injuries, a lot of times we try to figure out, okay, what's your movement pattern? How do we fix this so that way we can prevent you from, straining your hamstring with non-contact injury, for example. Pro, like NFL players, for example. These guys, I just kept getting injured and kept getting injured no matter how much functional movement stuff we did. And then we finally convinced them to tweak their nutrition and all of it went away. And I think I feel the same way with sometimes when I let my nutrition slip, if I'm like traveling, eating things that I'm just compromising on. I mean, it's like pretty rare now. Drinking alcohol, especially, like that kind of combo of stuff, stressed out, I will feel some old injuries in places. And I think that like there's always like a baseline level of inflammation, and it's, are you crossing that threshold? Yes or no? And so, lower inflammatory diets is something that I use for sure. And just assessing what are our patient's goals and what have they tried in the past? What has worked? What hasn't worked? I don't think that there's one solution for everybody. But that's a very long answer to your question, but.
No, that was perfect and very helpful. So I would love to talk about some of these like inflammatory diets, because there isn't a one size fits all. So it's really hard to like make recommendations for patients to listeners on what to eat, what the exact diet should be. Usually I generally tends towards like whole foods just don't have like super processed stuff. But can we just touch on some of the, like the most inflammatory foods that you found, including, I know that you've done a couple of podcasts on oils, and I think that's super interesting. And also just like a hidden ingredient that people have no idea is as inflammatory as it is. So if we could jump into that, that'd be great.
Yeah. I think that there are two different buckets here that I at least think about are foods inflammatory or not. One is, are they generally inflammatory for all humans? And then another one is, are they inflammatory for the individual because of past history of health conditions? So the first bucket, it's very clear to me that I was talking about, like the foods that have existed or have been created over the last 100 years are I don't think it's food. I think they're food-like substances that we eat, but I don't think it's actually food. So these are, in my mind, if you put three big buckets on them, refined fats, which are generally oils, seed oils, we can get into that, refined sugars, and refined grains, so like flours, things like that. Most of these things are actually found all together in the same food. So something like a donut, for example, flour, sugar, fried in oil. It's exactly what it is. Most things that people eat in excess, it's nuts. And so that bucket, I'm like, okay, everybody needs to just not eat these things. They are not food. They should be discarded and not even looked at. The second bucket is challenging because you need to really get into the nitty gritty here. So there's a lot of people who will say like, oh, lectins will kill you, nightshades will kill you, saturated fat will kill you. And I think that there's a decent amount of evidence that there are some people who do fine with them and there's some people who do not fine with them. And I think that that's where you have to figure it out. Just as also a very example, like done in the macronutrient perspective, carbohydrates versus fat or whatever, which should you eat more or less of? If you have a lot of metabolic damage for whatever reason, very high amount of sugar and more increasingly that I think of very high amount of polyunsaturated fatty acid consumption, so seed oils, things like that, you will literally damage your metabolism. Does that mean you never have to eat carbohydrate or you can't ever eat carbohydrate again? Maybe not, but it makes it much harder for you as an individual to eat carbohydrates. So the way I think about it is like, it's very easy to think about physical injuries and relay it to here to sort of like internal micro injuries. But if I'm going outside and I walk off of a curb and I sprain my ankle, I'm like, okay, eight weeks and I should be totally fine. If I go off that same curb and I fall down a bunch of stairs and trip and a bunch and break my ankle, well, it depends on what that break is, whether I heal or even have full function of my leg. But typically speaking, you're good, but you have to work around it, but you have a persistent injury. If I walk off that curb and get run over by a bus, like there's a chance that I literally may not be able to walk again. And I think the same thing happens for the insides of people where they can do such damage to themselves where, you know, autoimmune conditions, the ability to tolerate carbohydrates, things like this, you can restore that. For some people, and some people, I think they just have done too much damage where they need to then cater their nutrition and their lifestyle around that long-term. I don't think a lot of people like to hear that, but it's just the reality of it. And like, you would never argue that if you get run over by the bus, if you like, you know what I mean? It's like, okay, how do I function now? How do I accept where I'm at and where I want to go and then work around that? So those are kind of like the two ways that I would think about prescribing nutrition to people. And that is, you know, that's why I think a lot of people are having success with carnivore, but when they try to add back in foods, there's times where it goes totally fine. They eat like a normal whole foods, real food diet again, and some people can't ever do it again. There's nuance here, obviously, as with all stuff, where I think that sometimes the people on a carnivore diet just really aren't healing the underlying issues. And so they think that, you know, spinach is killing them. Or rice is giving them eczema or whatever. It's like maybe you have a gut issue that you're not addressing. So, you know, nutrition's a tool. It's a, I think, the biggest lever that we can pull, but it's not the only one. I think we always need to be thinking about like the same thing of where are you individually at? What is your history? Where do you want to go? What have you tried before? And how do we like sort of create these rules to make things, you know, less chaotic and less options, but like put you down a path that's going to be most effective for you.
Yeah, that's super helpful. And I would love to get into how people can tell how much damage they've done to the inside of their bodies. Because right now we don't have like great markers for like how much damage they've done, like with that great analogy that you presented. I know that a lot of people are using continuous glucose monitors now, but they're not mm-hmm. necessarily accessible to everyone. So how can people like really like tune into what their body's telling them, and how do they know that how much damage they've done or what they're potentially allergic to, even if they don't have like the stereotypical like anaphylactic like hives and can't breathe reaction to the food?
Yeah, I mean, I wish we had better testing. You said CGMs, continuous blood glucose monitors, can give you a sense of how your body processes carbohydrates, and that's it. You know what I mean? There's so many different things to measure. This is a good one. Levels is a good company if people want to like go direct to consumer and be able to get it themselves without a prescription. But they are helpful only in as far like as giving you feedback of how you feel generally. I think that there's this huge chasm between people understanding how they feel after they eat a food and tying it to the food. Sometimes if you eat something, especially a sugary thing, which is why the CGMs are so effective, I think – If you eat something and you feel low energy, but then you look at a graph and go, oh shit, my blood sugar spiked really high, then there's a good feedback loop of, oh, this type of food, like I feel tired because I ate this food, is now a thing that you start registering. With things like grains, what's tough about them is that they damage your gut lining and it takes typically like 7 to 10 days for that to start repairing itself. And so you're having more of a chronic exposure, especially if you're eating them all the time. Your gut lining is continually being destroyed. And so you could do a gut test. There's a bunch of those out there for that specific thing. But again, we're only talking about one tiny thing. And then in terms for like the seed oils, these are such a cumulative thing. They stay in your body for 2 years. So when you eat it, you're getting this microinflammation for that long. And so you can't even really, there's not like a cut it out and see how things change. And this is why the research with seed oils is really confusing, because you get people, you do an 8-week interventional arm. One group gets seed oils, one group doesn't. But these people have been eating seed oils their entire life. And so their baseline's already all jacked up. Not only that, you would have to first separate the groups, have one eat seed oil free for 2 years, test their polyunsaturated fatty acid levels, like their actual lipid bilayer, and then start the experiment, and then do it for 2 years, and then assess, and then see the markers. And so getting a marker for that is really, really challenging. But
everyone, you know, would love to fund that study.
Yeah, I mean, that is an absolute nightmare. Obviously, it's impossible, but it's tricky. I mean, this is where working with patients is just, you have to really meet the individual where they're at. Sometimes people are willing to go extreme and go like a complete elimination diet. And I think when people want to do that, something like a carnivore diet or a one food diet can be really helpful. I actually just read this book the other day from 1911 called The Milk Diet. And this is a guy who prescribed raw milk to all of his patients to cure all of their maladies. And it was fascinating how he talked about it, but he also talked about in the book the benefit of the grape cure, which is people just went to a vineyard and ate a bunch of grapes. And then he also talked about the apple cure, which people went to orchards and ate a bunch of apples and like only ate that for a long period of time. And then you have carnivore, which is like the newest thing that people are doing and feeling great on. But then you also have like the bean protocol, the cabbage soup diet, the Weston A. Price elimination diet is like just bone broth. Fasting is no food, but it's a singular thing. There's so many of these things that, you know, juice fast, et cetera, that people have used for a really long time. I don't necessarily think that there's probably anything magic about the one thing rather than just cutting out all of the trash. And I think letting your body get to a point of normalization. I think that there's likely dozens, if not hundreds of mechanisms that we do not understand yet. But if your body is always taking stuff in and having to work through it and process it, digest it, your nervous system has to respond to it, you never get back to an appropriate baseline. So I think that some of these like really restrictive diets can be super beneficial for your body just to calm down. And then you start adding foods in and taking a journal or writing through in a book and say like, how do I feel after I eat this food? Today, later on, the next day, et cetera. And then keep adding foods like that. Like, I think that's one way to do it. But on the other end of the spectrum, if the patient's not an extreme person and that seems too out of reach for them, then you like need to like look at, you know, maybe a food journal and see, hey, let's try taking this one thing out and go from there and do little bits. And I found it to be the case where it's like 40% of people, patients of mine, where they don't want to change anything or they don't want to change anything fast. And so it's like, you have to go bit by bit. 40% are extreme. And then 20% just don't, are like non-compliant and want you to fix something with a pill.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's, yeah, I think for everybody, it totally is dependent on their willingness to do it. But yeah, it's very, very challenging. Again, I think that people just shouldn't be eating those three foods that foods that I talked about, the seed oils, flours, sugars, et cetera. I think everybody could do better without those. But other than that, it's like it's a minefield. I'm now getting to experience a different level of food. Like I was talking about before, like the connection to food for me, just I feel like a different awareness around it, where I've been paying attention now for a very long period of time. How do I feel physically, whatever? And I'm now to the point where this is me saying this 5 years ago, I would have laughed in my face, but there is like an element of how the food is grown. If you think about what food is, it's like literally just a transfer of life. you're eating something that was once living, whether it was plant or animal, so that way you can continue living. And the more I got into farming and was doing farming, local food systems, stuff like this, it's like I can taste, it's not even taste, it's not even like a perception that I can put a finger on of something that I can measure. It's like I experience this thing when I eat food of like very high quality and how it was grown. We were traveling, we were in upstate New York a couple weeks ago, and the first thing I typically do when I go to places is I go get, like try to find a local farm, go buy a bunch of food, and that's what I eat. And so we did that. We found this incredible biodynamic regenerative farm that do dairy and meat and all this type of stuff, loaded up, and was eating all that. And then my wife had these organic strawberries that we had from at her mom's place that were like from Whole Foods and like that. And I had one of those as like a dessert. And I bit into it after eating all the other food. And my body just instantly knew like, oh, this isn't even food. Like, I don't know what the hell this is. But this isn't, like, there's no vitality in this food. There's nothing in this. And obviously I can't tell you what that means mechanistically or anything like that. But it's a very obvious thing to me now of just like when I eat food, I have this experience of like, is this nourishing me or not? And it sounds very woo and very ridiculous. But the more I tune into that, the better I feel. And sometimes I'll guide that to be like, eat way more fruit or way more carbohydrates or go more keto. Or like, we just got to Bend and I did the same thing with they have this awesome local shop here. Got some cream. I tried that and my body was like, oh no, like the smell was off. It tasted weird. Like, oh, this is not what I should be eating right now. Like, I didn't even need to have the experience of like, do I feel bloated or anything like that? Which I think is a layer of it. And I wrote in my email newsletter a couple of weeks ago around an experience I had with our farm. We were moving poultry around. So we had chickens intensively managed. And the whole thought is that the animals impact the land, fertilize it, scratch around, pee and poop everywhere. And then when they're gone, this will help improve biodiversity of the land. And a lot of people post like before and after photos or like side by side of this is where we had animals, this is where it wasn't. And where the animals were, there's like this crazy impact. Diverse forage, it's way more green, all this type of stuff. Well, I've been waiting for that at our farm. I haven't seen any of it. And I was really disappointed. I was like, man, did I do something wrong? What's going on here? And then we saw in the fall time when it was getting cooler and like deer were starting to go around, this family of six or seven deer that would come and eat at the spots where the chicken were. And so there was no discernible difference. There was no new forage. There wasn't different color. I went and like it didn't smell different. And Fred Provenza has written about this called Nourish in his book around how animals can like sort of have this intuitive sense of nutrition. But like you said, our disconnection from anything in the natural world, living on these computers all the time, I think we have a lot of capacity, just like any other animal, to have this intuitive sense and not have to understand every single thing as far as like, does it have this nutrient? Is it acting on this thing? Or do you have that whatever? And it's obviously having atrophied so much throughout our entire lives. I think about it like most people who, if they never walked their entire lives, if they were like literally kept their legs tied together and couldn't walk, and they started trying to walk, it's very, very challenging. It might not ever work and it might take a really long time. And the same thing is like with our intuition around food and nutrition and health, we have the capacity for it, but it's been so stunted by our separation of nature that, you know, I would love to see it come back. And I think that's one of the reasons why like supporting local farms, getting into this, people like you can go directionally towards that in a tangible way.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would love to talk a little bit as well about, I know I touched on it earlier, but oils. So what are some of these like inflammatory oils? Where can you find them? And which ones are healthier? Which ones are a little bit more inflammatory?
So seed oils are the things that they used to be called vegetable oils. And now people call them seed oils, which I think is a more appropriate name. I think vegetable oils is too generous of branding. these would be soy, sunflower, safflower, cottonseed, corn, canola, rapeseed, grapeseed, rice bran, peanut. These are oils from things that are not necessarily fatty that are produced in huge monocrops, very industrial processes to get the fat out and to put it into bottles. So the types of things we need to do to get seed, literal like cotton seeds, how this started, to get a jug of cottonseed fat requires so much ridiculous manufacturing, chemicals, etc. At the end point, you actually have something that we need to deodorize. And the deodorization process happens because rancid polyunsaturated fatty acids, which is the type of fat in the seed oils, which in the amount that we eat them in the seed oils, makes them so bad for us. What happens here is when those oxidize, when they react, they smell like rotten fish. That's why you smell fish the way it is because the polyunsaturated fatty acids, the omega-3s in the fish, start getting oxidized, and that's that like fishy odor. So when we process these seed oils, if we don't do the deodorization step, it would smell like rancid fish. But we, which is a good tool, which is again intuition for our body to go, do not eat that. That has spoiled. But we use machinery, chemical solvents, etc., to remove that. It doesn't mean that we remove the issue with the fats. We've kept them rancid. We've kept them to be a spoiled thing that we should not eat, but we've removed the signal to our bodies that we should not be eating them. So that is obviously an issue. We're eating, most people don't think that they eat them. They think that like, oh, I don't go buy a seed oil, I don't order a seed oil at a restaurant. I don't, you know, I'm not drinking this stuff. I'm not even cooking with it. How could I get it? 25% of our calories come from seed oils, which is mind blowing. It was zero 100 years ago, and now it's 25%. If you track the, you know, you said nutrition science is imperfect, and I totally agree, but there's sometimes where you see things like we saw smoking in cancer, and it was an appropriate thing. We're like, okay, started smoking more, had lung cancer. And there's obviously spurious correlations, and I don't want to say that everything is totally locked in here, but when you look through every single society that starts eating processed oils and ultra processed foods, which are full of processed oils and carbs and sugars, you see this rate of chronic disease start almost immediately afterwards. We've witnessed this across the entire planet. So I think it's insane that we don't pay more attention to that. But yeah, I mean, there's tons of people who are way smarter than me around why exactly these things cause inflammation, things like that. But I mean, just as a basic understanding, like I said before, these fats get incorporated into pretty much all of your tissues. The thing with when you eat sugar, this blood sugar spike, your body has to put it in different places as to store it. That can be an inflammatory process and can create advanced glycation end products, things like that. Not great, but overall, after you eat sugar, like you're pretty good after a couple hours. Your body is somewhat returned to homeostasis. With wheat, like I was saying, you have, you know, 7 to 10 days, refined grains where you have some gut issues, maybe some gluten intolerance, these proteins floating around. I, for example, interact with one of the wheat proteins that can produce acne. So every time I eat wheat, like three days later, I'll get acne on my face and like very predictable pattern, but then it's gone after like a week or two. With seed oils, your body is taking the fat as is. Like we don't have a lot of great conversion steps. And so when we eat protein and so these amino acids, these building blocks, we take it in and we kind of like build whatever we want. With fat, we have a very sloppy way to convert things and it's very rate limited. So when you eat certain types of fat, you then become that fat. And we are not supposed to be more than a couple percent, like most animals, of linoleic acid or polyunsaturated fatty acids, the amount we have right now. Most people, like we've seen this over time as well, people's percent of the fat that they're made up of has been rising dramatically over the years. And again, it takes up to 2 years or longer to get this out of your system. And so when you're think about like having your cells, your nervous tissue, everything else like that, all the contents of them are these polyunsaturated fatty acids, which are very unstable. These can damage surrounding mitochondria. They can cause cell death. They can fold in. So think about a cell like a beach ball. They can fold in and cause issues with cells. So that way receptors on cells are now in these deep channels and can't basically talk to other cells. So it screws up cell communication. It literally breaks how your body makes energy. I think the most of the insulin resistance is actually from consumption of seed oils. I've seen so many people on a ketogenic diet, especially working with my previous company, Perfect Keto, around they remove carbohydrates, put them back in, like feel good, put them back in, and then they can't, like still can't tolerate them. until they get to a point where they've removed effectively all polyunsaturated fatty acids and like eat high monounsaturated fat for a couple of years, a lot of these people can then start eating carbohydrates again. It's so obvious to me, like looking at carbohydrate metabolism, that it is more of a function of not overeating carbohydrates, but overeating these fats that break our metabolism. So when we do eat carbohydrates, we can't process them appropriately. I mean, if it were the problem with carbohydrates, we would have seen in pretty much every other culture that has high amount of carbohydrate intake, we would have seen massive rates of diabetes, but we don't. We don't see it in any Asian culture with the amount of rice, which is refined grain, and a lot of other like Katavans. There's a lot of like equatorial tropical populations that have no issue with diabetes. But again, when you introduce these seed oils to their food systems, obesity, diabetes, chronic disease, all skyrocket. And so, yeah, I don't think that there's any singular thing of what's killing people now and like leading to just mass suffering and disease. But I always try to ask, like, what are the biggest chunks that if we were to remove them or change them could make the most of my impact? And to me, it's sort of like undeniable at this point. It's the amount of this awful refined fat that we're eating.
That's a really great description about all of these like oils and things to remove from our diet, but they can be so sneaky and be found in so many different products. You mentioned saturated fat when some people go on keto. So what are some of the foods that have the most saturated fat or the healthiest fats? And then where can you find some of these vegetable oils / what should you be looking for in the ingredient list on some products?
Yeah, I think people like to bucket foods as this is saturated fat, this is whatever. If you look at the composition of meat, for example, and people tend to say like, oh, don't eat meat because it has saturated fat. And we could do another 25 podcasts around why saturated fat is not an issue. Follow Nia Teicholz's work. If you haven't had her on the podcast, I would highly recommend it. She's awesome. Her, the book, Big Fat Surprise, breaks all this down. Mm-hmm. But to go back, if you look at meat composition, meat has a tremendous amount of monounsaturated fat, which is what everybody says is the heart healthy fat in things like olive oil. And so the people who say, don't eat meat because it has this, well, it also has all the heart healthy fat that you said we should be eating a lot anyways. And so every fat generally has a blend of saturated, monounsaturated, and polyunsaturated fat. It's just which fatty acids and in what proportion sort of like make or break the difference. And so even when we look at fat, I'm working with a researcher out of Utah right now, University of Utah. His name is Stefan Van Vliet. Brilliant man. Also, you should have him on the podcast.
I actually have one scheduled with him.
Awesome. So he's finding too that, for example, long odd chain fatty acids. So fatty acids are just the things that make up fats, and they are just carbon chains. So how long is a carbon? How are the carbons bound together? It's pretty simple when you actually look at how fats are made. Obviously, you know all of this, but maybe not the listeners. And the odd number of carbon fats seem to have tremendous benefits. And so when you look at where we're getting these foods, he has done a lot of research to compare grain-fed, grass-fed, regenerative meat, beef especially. And the more the meat is raised in the way that it should be, regenerative, moving around, eating diverse pasture, things like that, they have way more odd chain saturated fatty acids. So even if you're looking at, is meat high in saturated fat? It's like, again, the nuance of things, you really need to dig deep and figure out what's going on. I think that eating grain fed meat is disgusting on many levels. So I try not to do that. But then you have to look at the research again. First of all, the research does not equate. I do not think it adds up. Again, Nina's work here has done a really great job parsing through that. But even when you're looking at it, like, where are they getting the forms of saturated fat from? What fatty acids are we looking at? We're not going that deep generally in these research articles. But if we were, we would see some of these things sort of be parsed out. But so you look at saturated fat is, you can think about it, meat, butter. People think about the things that are generally, they've been told for the last 65 years are really bad for them, or saturated fat, coconut oils, some tropical fruits, things like that. Animal fats, beef tallow. What's tricky about, you know, I was saying that the fats accumulate in us over time, the polyunsaturated fatty acids. The same thing happens with chicken and pork because they are monogastric animals just like humans. So if they eat something, they can't ferment it, break it down, build it back up like a cow can. They have to incorporate all that into their own tissues. It adds up the same way it does for us. And so pork and chicken 99.9% of them, this is the dirty little secret in agriculture that people don't understand, is they are fed GMO corn and soy. Even if they're the organic corn and soy, it does not matter. They're eating stuff that they should not be eating in amounts they shouldn't be eating it. And so they, just like us, incorporate all this in their tissues. And so people would think pork and chicken, maybe saturated fat, but they have high amounts of polyunsaturated fatty acids. And I think people, when they have lack of success in a carnivore diet and go only ruminants, this is why they're experiencing that, because they're cutting out polyunsaturated fatty acids with pork and chicken. So I don't think people need to eat an excess amount of saturated fat. I think I have a hypothesis that could be helpful if people are trying to accelerate getting polyunsaturated fatty acids out of the stores of their body. But overall, I think the biggest thing is just to understand where you're getting hit with these seed oils the most. And the answer to that, honestly, is packaged food and restaurants. Every single restaurant meal, or again, 99%+ of them, is loaded with these seed oils. This is where people are getting bombed with them. Even the best restaurants in the world use these seed oils. Why? Because they're flavorless and they're cheap and no one knows what kind of fat you're using. And so there's no experience, there's no taste to it. I'm not going to know, like if somebody gives me a gluten-free bread or whatever, I have this like, oh, this isn't as good as a real thing. Give me the real thing. But when it comes to fat, we don't have that feedback loop, and they can put that in all the sauces, all the dressings, they can fry with it, bake with it, all this type of stuff. And so don't think because you're going to a quote unquote nice restaurant that you're not getting bad quality products. A restaurant at the end of the day is a business. And a business, the point of a business is to make money. And that's not a bad thing, but the point of the business to exist is not to make you healthy. It's to make money. And so if that's the case, they have to find ways where they can get ingredients that aren't expensive. And seed oils being subsidized and being a very cheap industrial ingredient, you can use that and cut costs so that way you can make money as a business. I don't fault them for doing that, but it's tragic that people aren't aware of how much they're getting blasted with this stuff. Like there's no ingredient list on a restaurant. So whenever I go to a restaurant, which is actually not that often because this is such a pain in the ass, I'll say, hey, I have a sensitivity to oils. What are you cooking with? Can you cook with butter? And most places I can't get anything. Even the grills in most places are coated with oil. So even if you're kind of getting grilled meat, they do that. Almost every place will slather some sauce on, they'll marinate the meat. And so even if you're getting real whole foods, every salad dressing in restaurants made with these oils, anything saucy, the oils, like it's mind blowing. Like it's almost like it's impossible for restaurants to cook anything without the oil.
Yeah.
And so be the freak, be the weirdo, ask what they're cooked in, ask for butter, ask for olive oil. Even still, olive oil is typically cut with canola oil at restaurants because they need to have it be liquid at refrigerated temperature. Yeah. So yeah, it's a minefield. That's why I'm just like, screw it. I don't care anymore. And if I, you know, whatever, once a month or a couple times a year, I want to go have a meal and just send it and be like, I'm fine knowing my nutrition of having a couple meals a month that maybe I'll get some seed oils. Like I'm not paranoid that any consumption at all is going to kill me. I think that I have enough balance here where I can deal with it. So that's a big part. Packaged food. This is an easier way to look at it. So if you turn the box over and see anything with oil on it, just don't eat it. It's typically going to be with sugar, with some sort of processed like corn syrup, things like that. My friend just sent me a study on corn syrup as a tangent to or side to my tangent here, that it has the capacity to have the insulin impact of 4x the carbohydrates and actually combine to be 4x the carbs. So when you test carbohydrates to put in a nutrition facts panel, you're doing it in a certain way that doesn't actually look at how your body digests it. And so if you look at a bottle of Coca-Cola, for example, it says 50 grams of sugar, it's from high fructose corn syrup, but you're actually getting about 200 to 300 grams of sugar in that. Gosh. Carbohydrates. So avoid those things, obviously. But the seed oils, you can see that with the oil. The sneakiest one that most people fall for is sunflower oil because it sounds natural and healthy. Like it's not like some weird, like what the hell is a grape seed? That doesn't make any sense. Even that's another one, a canola, whatever. So sunflower is actually one of the worst offenders. It has one of the highest because it's grown in northern latitudes. And so the actual plant needs to have liquid fat for the plant metabolism to work. Not good for us because we shouldn't be eating those in massive amounts. So sunflower oil is one that for sure should be cut. And then I think that what like a real food source that people go nuts on, pun intended, is nuts in this case. And this is what, like with keto, you see a lot of keto recipes that have almond flours, whatever, like nuts have high amounts of these polyunsaturated fatty acids as well, which I think evolutionarily in a, it makes sense in the environment where they fall in the wintertime. Animals want to have insulin resistance and put on fat in the wintertime because there's scarcity of food for the next several months. So it's, I think it's a kind of an elegant solution for nature. The problem is that animals are getting like little bits in the fall as they're getting ready for fasting through the winter, basically. And we're eating handfuls of nuts every day, all year round, which is a very different thing. And so just say like, oh, well, nuts are natural and healthy thing. Like I don't buy it. But yeah, I think those are the main sources of restaurant, packaged food, nuts and seeds, and then meat that's given corn and soy.
Thank you for explaining that. And so I know that you have been talking a lot and getting more into regenerative agriculture. You have a farm, but you've mentioned biodynamic farming in the past as well. Can you just explain what the difference is between regenerative and biodynamic?
Yeah, regenerative is getting to be a loaded term that I think is pretty greenwashed right now. Where so that means that people are using it to signal that it's a healthy thing, but it doesn't really mean anything. They're not actually doing the things to regenerate. And so the theory about regenerative agriculture is most agriculture is degenerative. You are growing something, you're extracting something from the land. You are making the ecosystem more fragile. You're decreasing species, you're decreasing soil health over time. It's like a bank account. You're withdrawing to it until a point where we can't use it anymore. This has happened throughout human history many times, and we cannot learn our mistake. Like every time we've done this, civilization has collapsed and we're doing it again. Regenerative is using animals and ways of farming to put deposits back into the bank account. So instead of extracting from the land is becoming better by way of farming it. This is something that the plant-based eco freaks who think that meat's killing the planet, no matter what clips I show them, what farms I give as examples, they cannot get it through their skull that this is literally the only way of farming that we can do if we want to continue eating food as humans, period. It's a simple mechanism of, is the way you're making food, is it by definition sustainable long-term? It's not about how much food can we produce, as everybody argues. Well, is it, can you do scale regenerative to the feed the world? It doesn't matter. If we can maximally produce stuff, can we remain productive is the question we need to be asking. And in a system where you're only extracting and not putting anything back in, you're going to run out of resources. Just like if you spend all your money and don't make any, you're going to run out of money. It's very simple. And regenerative agriculture is a system, generally moving animals around, having multi-species, doing certain things with water, et cetera. We have a disagreement in the space around what is quote unquote regenerative. And this is one of the things you said before, like it's tough to measure complex systems with singular outcomes. Mm-hmm. And you can look at carbon in the soil. You can look at water quality. You can look at species diversity. You can look at all these certain things. Like, is it the input that you get? Is it the output you get? So there's some questions on that, but it's one of these things where kind of, like, you know it when you see it. And then we need farmers at farmer scale to be able to be the people who are doing this. This is why I want to support local farms, small farms, because even if it's an enormous industrial, quote unquote, regenerative farm, they're doing the practices. Well, if you have one person doing stuff with machines, you don't have the feedback loop. You don't have the intimacy with the land to know like, oh, this year is better than last year. This decade is better than last decade. And I think that again, with the food I was talking about, the deer, humans have an intuition on this is healthy, this is not healthy. Mm-hmm. And we need to trust that and lean into that more and be able to farm and have the farmer pay attention. Like one of the best regenerative farmers, Alan Savory, this guy walks around barefoot. This is how he assesses. He walks around in Zimbabwe where he's from, in all these pastures, and what they've done is incredible. His TED Talk, anybody who's interested in regenerative agriculture should watch it. These barren desert-like savannas, completely devoid of any life or water, He brings on cattle, starts moving them around in a regenerative concept. He calls it holistic management. There's now grass taller than he is. Rivers flowing through just by putting animals on the property. So this is the philosophy of regenerative agriculture. Obviously, I'm a huge proponent of it. As I get older, I just think about like, what about the generation after me? And what about them? And literally, like, if we cannot, it used to be like, how do people become healthy? Whatever. I don't even care anymore. Like, can we feed people, period, in the future? And if the answer is no, we need to change the system. The biodynamic is interesting because it plays to a lot of these things that I was talking about earlier, where I consider quote unquote woo. In the sense that Rudolf Steiner in the 20s came up with this guy, same guy who made up Waldorf schools. You may be familiar with that. Other people may have heard of those. More holistic, quote unquote, spiritual way to approach schooling and education. And he also came up with a way of farming, which is essentially what I think is the highest grade of certification. So when you look at GMO, free, organic, some of these other grass-fed, is now trying to do a certification. They have certain standards of like, you can do this, you can't do that. I think biodynamic is, like, factually, when it comes down to it, the most rigorous but also highest standard that you can get right now. Again, there's differing opinions on regenerative, what that means. So you have the tricky part here that most people don't like is that it's very spiritual in the sense of you have to do weird things all the time that don't make sense and probably don't make sense. And I don't care. I don't care if they make sense or not. For example, you have to do these things called preps. So you make these preparations and like you have to, at the certain moon cycle, bury like manure in a cow horn for X amount of days with rose quartz and then dig it up and mix it X amount of times with, you know, counterclockwise motion, et cetera, and then spray them in the crops. Does this do anything? Again, I don't care. What is the output? And I think that to do biodynamic farming, you have to suspend this rigid notion that I must know the facts at all times. Mm-hmm. I must have the facts and figures. I must have the data or else it doesn't work. It causes you to have to suspend that thinking, to love what you're doing and care about what you're doing. And how that impacts the food quality, I don't know, but the LPETs are undeniable. There's so much data that every measurable thing with food quality that we do think of right now that we know about is leaps and bounds better with biodynamic farming. But no one's willing to do legitimate studies on it because they don't think that the underlying principles and how to get there is scientific enough. It's travesty. Yeah. Most people in Europe don't give a shit either. I went to a bunch of biodynamic wineries when I was in Europe last summer, and all of them go, we don't really care because it makes the best wine. And this is another thing we look at the output of, okay, when we're tasting these things and we're seeing these outcomes, if you have to suspend belief of data and go like actually participate and be part of it, the dairy I was saying where I got this milk in Hudson Valley, the biodynamic farm, they was there, like they were mixing up this potion essentially that they were going to go walk around the perimeter of the property and do it. It's like you have people who are committed to the property first and foremost. Like that in itself is going to lend to a different type of caring about the property than just, again, the mentality of the restaurant is to make money. The mentality of a farm without this sort of greater purpose and spiritual nature, I think the purpose of the farm then is still extraction. Even if it's a quote unquote regenerative farm, the farm's still a business still needs to make money. So I don't think that you can't make money and care about your property. That's not what I'm saying. All I'm saying is that the more we can care, the less we have to be incentivized with maximizing profit at all costs, the better shot we have at keeping humans fed and ecosystems thriving around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, regenerative agriculture is essentially just indigenous land-based agriculture, as like indigenous people have been farming the land always. And they didn't have any studies to prove that what they were doing was creating a good output. But I'm actually working on the Food Fix campaign with Dr. Hyman to like increase regenerative agriculture. And we work with Rodale. We partner with Rodale Institute in Pennsylvania. And they have shown like through studies that in times of drought, their regenerative farms are actually more productive than industrial. And with climate change, I mean, if you're looking at studies and want to look at production and maximizing profit, that's one way to like leverage the argument for regenerative.
Yeah. And like, I mean, there's been tons of farmers who have also proven, Gabe Brown, Joel Salatin, are two vocal ones, that their yield dollar per acre has gone up over the years dramatically from switching to more of these ways of farming. And so even if you are trying to profit, it may be likely that this is the best way to do that, which is my hope, at least. I think my main fear is that we reduce it to carbon and we say, okay, it's all carbon. Like it is the same amount of foolishness that people, when people started getting obese, were, oh, it's just calories. Calories in, calories out. And then we figured out way later that Coke and all these other companies funded tons of research to prove that it's just a calorie and energy balance thing. We know that's not the case now, but it's still pervasive in our thinking that if you have any sort of excess fat or obesity, it's just you're eating the wrong amount of calories, which is the most absurd thing ever. And to look at human health and the reduction of, it's just calories in versus calories out. Again, insanity.
Yeah.
And the same thing if we start looking at ecosystems and food production as, oh, it's just carbon in, carbon out. Are you storing more carbon into the soil? I met with this venture capitalist who's funding a lot of stuff in this space. They just raised $800 million from all these celebrities. And he's talking about regenerative ag. He's like, oh, well, the problem is that if you start managing it poorly, then the carbon goes back into the atmosphere. I'm like, yeah. So the trick is not managing it poorly. The trick is keeping it in this thing. He's like, well, we're actually investing in this company that is sucking carbon out of the air and depositing it into the soil to get carbon out of the atmosphere into the soil. I was like, well, what do
like
you
a
mean?
Plant. Like,
yeah, exactly. I was like, what do you mean carbon? Like, how does it get into the soil? He's like, oh, well, it makes these like little rocks. It makes these little rocks. He's like, yeah, these little carbon rocks get put into the soil. I was like, well, how long do those last? He's like, well, hopefully thousands of years. Okay, great. So now we are going to, because we are thinking about this from carbon in, carbon out, we're going to extract carbon from the atmosphere and put carbon rocks into our soil that are going to stay there for thousands of years. Brilliant. And I think that like a lot of that type of thinking is going to lead to really disastrous outcomes in ecosystem health, just like calories in, calories out has led to it. Look at our chronic disease rate. Look at our obesity rate. It's going the wrong direction. So that's my main fear.
I completely agree. All these like technological like solutions with one measurable thing. So we ask all of our guests to finish the following sentence. The future is blank.
Can I edit it a little bit?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, I'm going to say the future has to be local in a sense of people get like, there's so much about, I think like human health and this spectrum of humanity right now, like if we want to continue as a civilization, as a species, in any form, we need to transform the way we're living entirely. And I think supporting small local farms is almost like a proxy to healing what is wrong with the way we're living it right now. If you look at like the average Western human, they are sick, fat, angry, distracted, disconnected, lonely, traumatized, list goes on and on and on. Times I think are going to get hard. I just met with Wendell Berry, this author, his house. He's this old guy, 80 plus years old. He's written tons of books on this stuff. I asked him, what are you most hopeful for? And he said that I'm most hopeful for your generation that the crash isn't too big. And it doesn't come all at once. And I said, oh, wow, that's really depressing. But thank you, sir. And I think like, we are headed towards a cliff. I hope we course correct. But if we want to stay resilient and keep producing food and keep having civilization in any form that we want, we need to get more back to local communities, people that are supporting each other, people who have skills, knowing the person who is providing you with your security, with your food, with your housing, having real relationships, being connected to the land, all of these things I think are incredibly important. And so I think that, again, if we want a future as a human, then it needs to be more locally focused.
I love that answer. Well, thank you, Dr. Gustin, for coming onto the podcast and spending time to chat with me about these really important topics. And I think that our listeners are going to learn a ton from this conversation.
Cool. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. The opinions expressed on this show are those of the Nuance and Medicine Explained and do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of their places of employment. The opinions expressed on this podcast are meant for entertainment and education purposes only and should not be used to diagnose or treat any medical condition, nor should they be used as a substitute for medical advice from a qualified board-certified practicing clinician.